Today, one of the two Afghan women at the table in the most recent round of peace talks with the Taliban speaks out. And in opinion, Gary Young on Knife Crime. Nearly 18 years after the American invasion of Afghanistan, the Trump administration says it wants to end the war and bring US troops home for good.
Great nations do not fight endless wars. After two decades of war, the hour has come to at least try for peace.
The details of how this withdrawal happens are crucial for Afghanistan, so landmark peace talks have begun. But when the Taliban met with delegates from Afghanistan in February,
it was a room full of men.
There were only two women present. Fawzia Koofi, a women's rights activist and member of the Afghan parliament, was one of them.
When I first went, I was not expecting that the issue of women's rights and civil rights and the gains we have had in Afghanistan over the past 18 years, the achievements, will be one of the main topics for discussion. And I said, I'm going to speak no matter what happens, if people are happy or not happy, I'm going to talk.
The Taliban are setting forward their terms to end the conflict. But the women who remember life under Taliban rule fear their freedom is at stake.
They're worried that not enough of the men in these talks on the Taliban side or the anti-Taliban side are really interested in women's rights.
From The Guardian, I'm India Rakesan. Today in Focus, will peace in Afghanistan come at the price of women's rights?
We got there actually at 4 o'clock in the morning.
Fawzia Koofi is an MP in Afghanistan. She spoke to us from the capital, Kabul. Our story begins just as she arrived in Moscow in February, where she had been invited to take part in preliminary talks with the Taliban, with the goal of creating a framework for a future peace agreement. She was among the delegation of 40 Afghan civilians, meeting with 10 members of the Taliban. And Fawzia quickly learned that just getting an invitation to the event didn't guarantee her voice would be heard.
And at 10 o'clock, I received a call from people who were arranging it downstairs that, Ms. Koofi, the official talks actually start at 2 o'clock, but there is now informal talks going on between 10 Taliban negotiation team and 10 people from Afghanistan delegation, kind of the leaders of the delegation. So you should come down around 2 o'clock from your room and go to the formal meeting. This was the moment that I kind of felt uncomfortable, but I did not come to Moscow to stay in my room in the hotel. I came here. I have a big responsibility. I need to be there on the table when they talk, on the negotiation table.
So you were clearly quite insulted that you hadn't been invited to these earlier talks, but you just headed there anyway, didn't you?
So I went downstairs unprepared. I was, in fact, with sandal when I went there. I was even not, with the official dress. So I went and find the room where the 20 people were meeting without any woman. And they told me that only these people are allowed, you are not allowed. So I texted the organizers and I said, I want to be there in that on the table. I'm not here to just sit in my room. I want to be part of any talks that are formal or informal. When I entered the room, I was worried because this was the first time I meet some people who really extremely have opponents in terms of views with me, or we oppose each other's views. I enter and then for 1 or 2 minutes I sat there and I listened to their speeches. After that, I raised my hand because, I said, whatever happens, I'm going to speak here. I will not sit quiet. If people are happy or not happy, I'm going to speak here. So I raised my hand. I said,
That was after just 2 minutes of being in the room.
Yes, yes. I said, I have one message, and the message was very short. And the message is that people of Afghanistan will not go back to the time that you were ruling Afghanistan. We have come very far, especially women of Afghanistan. We will not reverse. I just wanted to make my presence visible. That was the whole thing.
Fawzia, you were one of two women in that room. And were you both there specifically to talk about women's rights? Or did you feel like you were there to talk about all the issues on the table?
No, I just felt that I should talk about every issue that my people are concerned about. But, women's rights is the entry point because it's so related to many other civil rights liberation in Afghanistan. So if you talk about freedom of speech, that would not be achieved if women are not allowed to exercise their basic rights. If you talk about civil freedom, about rule of law, about people's power, these things closely linked with women participation. So therefore, women participation was an entry point.
So women's rights were discussed at the table, and there was also a lot of talk about amending the constitution. And then there was this huge issue of the withdrawal of international troops. What's your view on the withdrawal, Fawzia?
During the last day, I made my point very much clear on the record. I said Taliban are not the only violent extremist groups in Afghanistan, are the ones that are fighting, I would say, paramilitia groups. We have other groups that are security threats, like ISIS, like regional networks that are functioning in Afghanistan, from Central Asia, from South Asia. So even if there is some kind of peace arrangements with Taliban, that does not mean completely peace in Afghanistan. And therefore, I think completely withdrawal from Afghanistan is not in the mutual security interest of Afghanistan and the world, too. Therefore, I ask that in the declaration they should put that there should be somehow international guarantor present in Afghanistan in a form of military. And this was my view that I presented there too.
Fawzia's experience of war has left her in favour of a continued international military presence in Afghanistan. She fears what could become of the country in a power vacuum. The Guardian's Emma Graham Harrison has been reporting on Afghanistan for a decade. I asked her what the situation was like for women under the Taliban just before the US invaded in 2001.
It was probably the worst it's been, in modern times. The Taliban had an incredibly misogynistic regime. Women were barred from education, from work. They had to wear the burqa when they go out. And they were so fierce, they would sort of go around looking for people to whip if their ankles were showing. You weren't allowed to wear high heels. They considered the sound of high heels sort of provocative. I think there were bans on makeup. So essentially, women were expected to stay at home. They did make a few exceptions. Women were allowed to work as doctors for other women, but they had to be accompanied by male guardians at all times. So essentially, most women, if they stayed in Afghanistan, spent the sort of 5 years that the Taliban were in government essentially stuck at home.
So then, of course, came the US-led invasion in 2001. How did conditions for women change then?
So one of the things about the US invasion, I think it's really important to remember, is that it was driven largely by a desire for revenge after the 9/11 attacks on America.
Good afternoon. On my orders, the United States military has begun strikes against Al-Qaeda terrorist training camps and military installations of the Taliban regime in Afghanistan.
But quite soon it came to be presented also as a war for women's rights. You had people like Laura Bush talking about how, you know, the West was going to Afghanistan for women's rights.
Good morning. I'm Laura Bush, and I'm delivering this week's radio address to focus on the brutality against women and children by the Al-Qaeda terrorist network and the regime it supports in Afghanistan, the Taliban.
So I think when we're talking about the West's obligations to Afghan women, our commitments, whether we have responsibilities there, I think it's quite important to remember that for a long time this was a war that was ostensibly being fought in the name of women's rights.
Afghan women know through hard experience what the rest of the world is discovering. The brutal oppression of women is a central goal of the terrorist.
I mean, even at the time, that seemed to me a pretty cynical exercise, frankly.
Were promises made to women in Afghanistan by America?
Yeah, huge promises. I think quite arrogant promises. You know, I think the whole project of the West in Afghanistan was based on the idea that you can remake another country in your image, which is both arrogant, patronizing, and incredibly dangerous.
The name of today's military operation is Enduring Freedom. We defend not only our precious freedoms, but also the freedom of people everywhere to live.
Afghans should be the ones who rebuild their country and who get to decide what it looks like. And, you know, to give the project of rebuilding Afghanistan credit where credit's due, a lot of women's rights were enshrined in the constitution.
When did that happen?
So there was a big lawyer jirga, which is a sort of traditional Afghan gathering. I mean, it would traditionally have been a tribal gathering. This obviously involved a lot of technocrats as well as tribal and other leaders. And they drafted a constitution which was ratified in 2004.
I pray to God the Almighty that this constitution will guide the way for the government and the people of this country towards observing...
Enshrines women's rights, among other things. Women have a right to 25% of the seats in parliament, protects their right to education, to work.
And you arrived in Afghanistan in 2009. You know, clearly things weren't great for women, but what did you see when you arrived in the country?
So I think one of the things that happens a lot is people talk about Afghan women and they don't talk to Afghan women. And obviously I found a country where conditions for women are incredibly difficult. But it was also a country where I found these just incredibly impressive, brave women who were fighting against just really, really difficult odds. Sometimes they were fighting their own families in order to fight for other women. Just really incredible.
So now we do have this situation where the US is trying to leave Afghanistan. Why is this such a priority for Trump?
I think public opinion in America has shifted generally. It's not actually just Trump. I mean, the New York Times said in an editorial that it was time to bring the troops home. And that's a pretty momentous shift because for 17 years, they've reported very critically on what's been happening in Afghanistan, but they've supported the war ideologically. So I think partly for political reasons, partly for financial reasons, Trump has sort of decided that he wants this war to end. I think there's a sense among a lot of Americans that essentially the war is unwinnable.
So peace talks have begun. They began last year. What are the terms for peace?
It's almost too early to be talking about the terms for peace. So these are more preliminary talks. The Taliban are pretty clear. Their number one desire is to get the Americans out. The Americans' number one priority is that Afghanistan doesn't become a base for international terrorism again. In many ways, that's not such a big thing to ask of the Taliban because they have traditionally been a nationalist group. They are not interested in international jihad. They're interested in controlling Afghanistan. One of the questions, though, about any peace deal is how is it enforced? You know, do the Taliban make agreements, whether they're about women's rights or al-Qaeda, that are simply paying lip service to the West and then American troops leave? There's no method of enforcement and women's rights are thrown out the window.
What have the Taliban said about women's rights at these talks?
The Taliban know that even if women's rights are not politically as big an issue as they should be or as I think they should be, they're something that will come up. And so they did directly address the issue of women's rights and they essentially made two quite contradictory statements, so you could sort of take from it what you will in a way. They said Islam protects women's rights to education, to work, to various other things, but in the same statement they attack women's rights activists, essentially saying that they'd brought immorality and indecency to Afghanistan. So on the one hand, you could be optimistic that they'd publicly acknowledge women's right to work and education under Islam. On the other hand, you know, women's rights activists are the people who've made sure that those rights can be exercised to the degree they can. So an attack on them is not very encouraging.
This next era in Afghanistan's history could bring new dangers to women's rights activists like Fawzia Koofi. But she can't imagine doing any other kind of work.
Working for women's rights was in the kind of corner of my heart from day one because I was seeing what is going on around the family with the woman of my family.
Fawzia, can I ask? I read that when you were born, your father left you out in the sun to die.
Yes, not my father. When I was born, my mother was not happy because she was expecting a boy. My father already had his last wife, and his last wife was younger than my mother and than all his wives. So in order to regain the love of my father, my mother wanted to have another son, not a daughter. When I was born, she was not very happy. And, you know, life in the village, when you deliver baby by then, there was no medical services. So my mother, she was going through severe pain, and they just put me on the sun because everyone was busy with my mother. And I got sunburn in my face. But at the end of the day, she realized that, you know, she has to give me some love. I think my mother wanted to have a boy because she didn't want another girl to suffer as much as she suffered as a woman.
Fazi, did you grow up knowing that that's what happened to you when you were a baby girl?
Yes, and I think that was perhaps one of the other reasons that I wanted to fight gender inequality and gender discrimination, because I know, you know, other women and girls should not have this kind of welcome that I had to this world just because of their gender.
Your father didn't allow any of his daughters to go to school, but then after his death, your family had to move away from your village to the city, and you did go to school, and you were a very good student, you wanted to be a doctor, you were attending medical college, and then the Taliban arrived. How did life change then?
I never thought that, you know, Taliban will stop all of that for us. Taliban gave back-to-back decrees that women university should be stopped. They cancelled all weddings that were planned in the big hotels. And that's why, you know, they asked all the women to wear burqa. You know, that's how then the kind of the dark period for many women life started.
When the US invaded Afghanistan, they made a lot of promises about women's rights. What happened?
We understand that the main goal for United States and NATO forces to come to Afghanistan was not women liberation. The woman issue was linked with all the liberties that as a result of international community came to Afghanistan. Initially, I think everything was in the right path. But after the Iraq invasion, after the war in Iraq, I think this gave a space for Taliban in Afghanistan to re-emerge. And therefore, not only women's rights had some step back, but also security-wise, we had, you know, a deteriorating security situation.
This seems like a very fast withdrawal. How worried are you that peace is going to come at the cost of women's rights?
Very much, because I know that women of Afghanistan were the main victims of war. They lost their family members, they lost their children, they lost their husbands. Above all, basic rights were taken away from them. Therefore, we don't want to be victim of peace. And I think not only for the sake of women's rights, but for the sake of future stability of the region, the international community should not completely withdraw from Afghanistan.
When I got to Afghanistan, there was a lot of, I would really call it Western propaganda about progress that had been made in women's rights, about how fantastically everything was going. There was a lot of money being spent and there was a desire to have a narrative of progress. I felt that the Western governments were trying to tell a story that was not justified by events on the ground. But what's happened now is I almost feel that things have flipped round to the other direction, where you have a sense that, well, you know, Afghanistan's going really badly. Any money spent there is wasted. We just have to sort of cut our losses and run. Well, you know, it's a terrible place for women anyway. And I sort of feel it's really important now as a journalist to underline that, of course, there has not been enough progress for women. But there's been an incredible improvement. And the idea that the West would just walk away from that, particularly when they used women as one of the pretexts for going into this war in the first place, I just think is really wrong.
The US withdrawal, what would stop the Taliban returning to the levels of control they had in 1996?
The worst case scenario is that Afghanistan slides back into full-blown civil war, that you don't reach a peace deal, or it's a peace deal that the Taliban don't respect, that fighting continues. There's a lot of men in Afghanistan who have had military training. There's a lot of weapons floating around. And if Afghanistan slides back into civil war, it's likely that women will lose a lot of what they've gained.
You can follow all of Emma Graham Harrison's reporting online at theguardian.com. Next, with two more teenage deaths from knife crime over the weekend, Gary Young questions what solutions are really being found. Now, NHS data shows that in the last 5 years, knife attacks on teenagers have risen 93%. This weekend, two more teenagers died from stabbings. Jodie Chesney and Yusuf Galib Mackie, The Guardian's Gary Young has spent over a year reporting on knife crime in the Guardian series Beyond the Blade. He questions how the identity of the victims can affect the way we report on their death.
So over this weekend, there's been two young people stabbed to death. One was a young woman who was stabbed in a park. And then the other murder was of a young man just outside of Manchester. And the way that these two deaths have been reported has been intriguing because the young woman was active in the Scouts, some kind of youth group. She was in some ways a kind of model youth, and the young man went to a private school. I think he wanted to be a doctor. There is a sense that these are particularly shocking because these were two young people with a future, and these were two young people with promise. And the unstated part of that is that the other kids had no promise. There is this notion that we have that I was raised with at journalism school. When a dog bites a man, that's not a story. And when a man bites a dog, that's a story. And so when these kids who are young and poor and brown and black are killed in certain areas of London and elsewhere around the country, when people say that's not news, what they're saying is they don't really care when the dogs bite people so long as it's not their people. Now, every death is a tragedy. This does not in any way detract from the tragedy of their death or any other death, but it does speak volumes about the mediated choreography around these young deaths. Some deaths do not shock. These do. I don't know why either of these two children died the way they did. I don't know. But I wonder what the youth club provision was like in the area where the young woman lived. She's out in the park with her friends. Well, there's been a massive cut in youth clubs, and that matters as to where children might be. I wonder when we look at the assailants, the degree to which they may have had a mental health challenge, because roughly, I think, 150 or 250 kids every day are turned away from child and adolescent mental health services. I wonder if it's a young person who's involved, whether they were excluded. Because a large number of these deaths, both the kids who were killed and the perpetrators, they have been excluded. This doesn't come out of nowhere. There are structural underpinnings to this rise in youth violence. When a child or youth dies, that's already a failure. And when a child or youth has killed them, that's a double failure. Of course, they have personal responsibility, but there's a collective responsibility, and we are letting our kids down. People hear about these things, they get worried about them. Young people decide to carry knives because they're worried. You're more likely to use a knife if you have it, obviously, than if you don't, and you're more likely to get stabbed if you have a knife. Strategies do exist. The public health model in Scotland has worked well, for example. But public health models demand public spending. And if you're living in a period of austerity where they're cutting everything, then the chances that you are going to be able to fix this thing is very limited. So on the one hand, you have the panic of the young. And on the other hand, you have the indifference, or worse still, the kind of punitive policies of the old. And that's the real tragedy.
That's all for today. My thanks to Fawzia Koofi, Emma Graham Harrison, and Gary Young. Today's programme was produced by Mithili Rao and Amy Walker. Sound design is by Axel Kakutier, and the executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll see you tomorrow.